Welcome to Card Knock Life. I'm Corey, and here's Daryl.
Yo.
And we are going to go deep on Modern today. I hope you're cool with that, Daryl.
Are we going to go through the breach?
We're going to go through the breach. We're going to go into the void. Last time I said we're going to go deep on Modern, you said, oh no. Or you're like a little concerned about that because you maybe were not so high on Modern. But I hope your opinion has changed a little bit as the format has significantly changed since then.
So, I still don't really hate the format, but I'm not in love with it. I am pretty neutral right now. I've just been playing not competitively,
yeah.
And I think that's made me feel a lot better about it.
Yeah, probably yeah. So. I think every week we look at it, you get a different take on the thing because it really is so different every week.
I've just been trying to find all the decks I can play Search for Ashkanta in and do dumb stuff. Like this week, I was finding Cruel Ultimatums and Batter Skulls with my Search for Ashkanta.
Nice.
Yeah,
you'll have to elaborate on that later in the cast here as we get into our Modern session.
Oh, it's not good, but I will.
Let's start with the latest news in the Magic world, and that is not very Modern, but it is actually unstable. It is silver-bordered. Daryl, you said you didn't have a chance to draft the format.
I bought a couple packs just to get some cards.
Okay.
I did not pull a spike.
You did not. Okay.
No one that I played EDH with this week or last week decided they were going to take advantage of the silver border cards being legal.
Oh, really?
In Commander, yeah.
Well, we had a big drafting hoopla on Saturday, and it was a blast. That set is really freaking fun to draft. I know that not everyone in the draft had the same reaction to it, but that may have been based on some mana screw and things like that. I'd say that as far as balance goes, like it is really well balanced. It's a phone limited environment. I played a deck. My first pick was one of the contraptions that says you can.
Was it Basic Island?
No, it was not.
So here's my question: Some guy draft all the basic lands?
No, we put the land. In fact, we did a draft in a way that the person that bought the box just kept all the cards because we had a couple people that didn't want to pay for them.
Okay.
But we had I think we had five players, which made it a little awkward. There was a buy in there, but it was still fun.
Okay, I was going to say, because I feel like if I was in a pot of eight players, I would just draft the basic land until there were no basic lands left.
Yeah, I mean, clearly that's where the value lies in those things.
But, yeah. All right, sorry. I got distracted by drafting and thinking I just wanted to draft the basic land every time, which makes me a bad person, but whatever.
Anyways, I picked a contraption that said you can when it's cranked, you can put a creature from an opponent's graveyard into play under your control.
Oh, that's real good.
And then the immediate next pick I grabbed was the when it's cranked, you may have target player mill for the number of creatures you control. And I ended up with two of those in the first pack because there's a foil one and a non-foil one going around.
Oh.
So out of like five total contraptions, I had two mill cards and one reanimate card.
So you were definitely playing the Goblin Explosioneers faction?
I was indeed. Yeah, the Goblin Explosioneers have a guy that's a common. He's one red for a 1/1 goblin that cranks or that assembles a contraption when he comes into play. That card is like first pickable good. That is extremely powerful in this format where like
so,
two mana cards that can crank assemble contraptions cost like 6 mana to activate. And like a lot of the instants and sorceries that crank, I keep saying that, assemble contraptions cost like 4 or more. Like it's quite expensive to do.
So is he just a first pick? Because are there contraptions in every pack? Like this is something I don't know.
Yeah, there are two contraptions in every pack, so he's just good no matter what.
So there's always stuff to pick from, so you can just absolutely. Like slam that guy and then take contraptions. Okay, that seems pretty solid then. I'm in.
Yeah. My other half of my contraption deck, actually I had 6 contraptions, I think, because one of them was, or two of them had something to do with target creature becomes an artifact, and then they get to do stuff, they get activated abilities until end of turn. And so there's like a whole series of those kinds of cards. Like one of them lets you tap a creature for 3 life, one of them gives a creature vigilance and +1/+2, but they all make those creatures into artifacts. So the third contraption in that part of the in that part of my deck was destroy target artifact when you crank it. So I put on the same sprocket as one of those, and I can use it as creature removal every 3 turns.
That's pretty solid. All right.
Yeah.
I see what you did there.
So since the contraptions are so powerful and there are lots of artifact creatures in the set, like artifact removal is like extremely good, high pick, absolutely main deckable. And there are some of the augment creatures that whenever they come into play, they destroy an artifact, and when you augment them, they can have repeatable ways to, you know, destroy artifacts, be it, like, when two or more creatures attack, if it's the Hummingbird, or you can pay 3, exile a card from a graveyard and, you know, destroy a target artifact, if it's the Zombie. And that card is extremely good. Like, there seem to be a lack of like, abundant artifact destruction to deal with people's contraptions, but that guy is a common, I believe, and that was a definitely a good thing to pick up early on and often.
Oh, yeah. Sounds like just disrupting everyone's plans would be perfect.
Yeah. Now, any arguments about the set not being balanced or the set being unfair, I feel like are nearly void, because the point of it is not to have a competitive environment, it's to have a fun environment. So I did pass up on cards that I think are not the ideal plan for my deck, but it was like, man, I really want to try this Hangman out. And he was good anyway, but I just wanted to have some fun with it. And some of those cards were like too fun to pass up on.
Did anybody open Spike and then immediately go looking for their binder?
No, we actually had a stack. The person that brought the box, my friend John, who actually runs the discard.com, he's the one that brought the box and brought that along. He had a stack of banned and restricted cards in sleeves for us to pick from for Spike if we had drawn it.
The question is, did he include the combo? Because if not, then get him out of here.
What's the combo?
I think you can do it with just 2 colorless. I think you need extra life, but it's just like LEDs and a bazillion Second Sunrises.
Oh yeah.
Or Black Lotuses if you have those laying around, you know. Because you can just use Spike the Tutor for a couple of those, and then you break them, and then if you get 3 of them, and then you break all 3 and tutor a Spike for Second Sunrise and cast it, then you get them back and you break it. You then can make infinite mana as long as you have a giant stack of Second Sunrises.
Yeah.
So then you can just, like, play whatever banned cards you want, because then you can go get, like, Balance, and you Mind Twist your opponents. And then, like, you can just, like, Emrakul them and whatever, like...
No, he did not include that, but I feel like there should be some amendment on that existing. Basically, if you have enough life to pay the Phyrexian mana, you win, right?
Or you just have, like, mana laying around.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, but yeah. No, it's super busted. Like, because you can also use the LEDs to fuel the next LED. Yeah. So, like, you can break the LED for 3 black, activate Spike, pay 2 life, go get another LED, break it for 3 black, activate Spike, pay 2 life. So you can do that twice, and then you can pay 8, or maintain priority, break it for white, and Sunrise, and then just go off.
Nice.
Yeah, it's pretty dumb.
I knew that there was something just totally broken in Spike, and I wonder how many people did that at the release events.
I mean, to be fair, you would have had to brought 3 $100 cards, and then a literal giant stack of Second Sunrise, like enough to get yourself to 15 mana to cast Emrakul.
That's fair, yeah.
You know, like I imagine someone just like played Spike and went and got a GTA.
Yeah, right.
And it's just like, all right, I win. GTA. Like, you know.
Well, the Second Sunrise can't be too expensive. If you play Legacy and you've got the Lion's Eye Diamond.
Yeah, you need 3 of them, but let me check TCG Player or Second Sunrise price here.
Yeah, Second Sunrise currently out of stock, it says. Oh, no, it's there. Oh, $1.50.
You can get them for 82 cents a piece.
Yeah, I wonder if the price on this card has gone up a little bit due to that combo existing.
Yeah. Who went and bought like 20 of them so that they could Second Sunrise their way to Emrakul?
I was actually curious too if like Legion's pack prices went up after Gather the Pack was spoiled. I don't think that they did, but now here's the thing with Legion's packs: Phage the Untouchable.
Yeah, in there.
Is in that set, and that would just straight up lose you the game.
Yeah, you're dead.
I don't know that you have a choice. I think you have to put all the creatures into play, don't you?
You do. Legion's booster pack's $8.
Nice. Okay, well.
Actually, $11, so it's $8.95 plus shipping and handling.
But is that higher than they were? That's what I'm wondering.
Possibly. There's no little graph thing for the price trend of Legion's packs.
Okay. Yeah, there's nothing in Legion's that I can think of that's really worth much of anything. I mean, Toxin Sliver is the most expensive single that I'm seeing online right now. It's like $4, $5. A Chroma Angel of Wrath, Magma Sliver. Basically, the slivers are the draw.
Yeah, nothing I can think of.
Yeah. So, anyways, let's jump to the next thing. I will leave this by saying that Unstable Draft is seriously one of the most fun draft formats I've ever played, and so I would highly recommend doing it.
I'll give it a chance.
But let's jump there. Just a couple of spoilers before we get into Modern Land. And these are Rivals of Ixalan spoilers. Three of them officially announced now today, as they were kind of spoiled in their own interesting ways. The Captain's Hook with no mana cost at a certain point. But the first one, we'll talk about the Captain's Hook since I just mentioned it. This is an artifact equipment for 3 mana. Equipped creature gets +2/+0 and has menace and is a pirate in addition to its other creature types. If it becomes unattached, you have to sacrifice the permanent that it was attached to.
Destroy the permanent. Very relevant.
Destroy the permanent. Thank you. And it has equip 1.
Yeah, like, if you make your permanent indestructible, very relevant.
Yeah.
But, like, this is a really strong equipment. Like, it costs a lot of mana, which is awkward.
Yeah.
But, like, you paid 1 for Bone Splitter, and it was cool. And people even played Darksteel Axe, which cost 2 to equip, and they were cool with that. So, like, making it a pirate is probably relevant for something in Ixalan, aside from, like, Beckett Brass, you know?
Yeah.
But maybe there's something, like, if you have a pirate do a thing, like, that could be totally relevant. And Menace is a non-zero evasion ability. Like, it's a very good ability.
Absolutely.
And so, like, I could see this getting some standard play as, like, a 1 or 2 of an aggro decks, just because the equip cost is so low.
Yeah. Now, I don't know if standard currently is a format in which you could take a turn off to play a 3-mana equipment.
Sure.
But the equip cost being 1 makes it pair pretty well with, like, you know, maybe a 3-mana haste creature on turn 4 or something like that.
Yeah. It might be something that after energy rotates, because then there will be less pull to have, like, a bunch of artifact destruction for, like, Warlord Virtuoso tokens and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And vehicles. Yeah. So, like, maybe after energy rotates out, this could be a card that sees some play.
Now, with energy, I could see this being pretty powerful when attached to a Long Tusk Cub. Long Tusk Cub on 2, Captain's Hook on 3, and then making it evasive means the damage is going to stack up, and also you're going to accumulate quite a bit of energy.
Yeah, Glorybringer is one that I thought of that would be very nice to put this on.
Yeah. So I don't know. It's definitely good for EDH. There's no doubt about that.
Any equipment is
typically good for EDH, and this one seems to provide some useful effects. Now,
Equipments with a low cost, like the equip costs,
right,
are usually really good in EDH. Like, it's hard to justify stuff like Argentum Armor when you're not cheating.
Yeah. I can see this shining particularly in places where you can take advantage of the becomes unattached from a permanent, destroy that permanent effect. Whereas you can pay 1 mana to sacrifice a permanent. That's an ability that is worthwhile, and it's the reason that, like, what is it? The High Market is an expensive land. So, probably good. I don't know if the fact that it costs 1 to do it, it gives it combo potential or not, but there's a possibility there.
I mean, there are creatures that make the equip cost less, so you could just, like, move this thing around.
Yeah.
If you have, like, a Blood Artist, you could just run down a line of tokens.
Yeah.
With this. Yeah. But these are, like, corner case things that if you do, like, generate equip costs costing less, you can do something like that.
Now, is there a threaten effect in Standard that's worth playing? Because this seems good with a threaten effect. Take the creature, equip it, and unattach it to kill the creature.
So when you take the creature, you don't get the equipment unless the fight says so. The equipment is still controlled by your
creature. No, I mean, if you have the equipment, you take their creature, put your equipment on their creature, and then remove it at the end of turn. Or in your second main phase, I should say.
Yeah, that could be a thing. But more than likely, this would already be on the creature you had.
Probably.
So you'd, like, be, like, awkwardly 2-for-1-ing yourself, which seems kind of bad.
Yeah. Well, regardless, the flavor of this card is awesome. The art is cool. I'm surprised it's not a legendary. It seems like it would be legendary if it's the Captain's Hook, but I suppose there are lots of captains out there.
Yeah. I mean, we haven't even met the captain yet. We've met the Admiral, Beckett Brass.
Yeah, that's true.
But yeah, you would expect the captain. If the admiral is legendary, the captain also, I would expect to be legendary.
Maybe the captain has two hands.
Maybe. Who knows?
And we don't have any half legendary permanents yet. Now, it's interesting to me that it says becomes attached to a permanent or unattached from a permanent, I should say, rather than a creature. There are a few cases where even if you animate an artifact, it's still a creature. So the fact that it has to point out a permanent, maybe they're just trying to avoid any kind of weird rules moments.
Vehicles.
Vehicles, okay, that could be it, yeah. But there's no way to get around. Now that the vehicle is no longer a creature, you can safely remove the hook.
Yeah, like when it becomes no longer a creature, the hook destroys the vehicle.
Yeah, probably a corner case, but...
Yeah. Anyways, it's relevant and standard. They printed a 210 vehicle, they printed a boat, then another boat, yeah. And then there's all the Kaladesh vehicles, so I think it's very relevant.
Yeah. That's true, it's pretty relevant, or it's especially relevant on the 2-6 boat or whatever it is that flips, right? It flips into
the 210 boat, yeah.
210, yeah.
Well, it'll flip... And so if it just transforms and doesn't exile itself, it will destroy the land.
Okay.
Because yeah. It should be the same permanent.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I mean, the fact that they've included that is relevant there, right?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so then the other one's quick. Evolving Wilds is back in the set. This art looks fantastic. It's really cool.
Yep, well done.
I think
well
it's going to be a great foil. Definitely,
it is a foil. Yeah,
definitely the Evolving Wilds of choice. If you're looking to include one in EDH deck, I don't think it any other art stands up to this one. This is the best.
I mean, I haven't put in Evolving Wilds in EDH deck in a while, but you know, that's well, because I played Legacy and have a set of fetch lands.
That's right.
First world problems. I'll admit it.
There are plenty of people that run Evolving Wilds in their deck, and they should not be ashamed for it either.
Oh no, not at all.
Alright, the last one, Brass's Bounty, 6 and a red. For each, it's a sorcery, by the way. For each land you control, you create a treasure token. That's it.
So this is basically Red's Boundless Realms,
yeah.
Yeah, I was like, I can't remember. So this could actually make a Grixis control deck a thing?
With Revel the Riches?
Revel the Riches.
Yeah.
Because, like, if you can wrath the board on turn 6 and kill a few creatures and then play this on turn 7, like, you have enough treasures to end the game, and then you also get to keep counterspells up in case, you know, something disastrous would happen instead.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, it's not insane, but it's not horrible.
Yeah, it pretty much does, like, nothing if you top deck it other than provide you extra mana for whatever thing you might draw later.
Yeah, so what... Can you get advantage from having treasures? And if the answer is yes, then like if your deck can take advantage of treasures, you'll just lay around. Like if you play Marionette Esther, or you have the land that's like sack a treasure, draw a card, or you have Revel in Riches, or whatever generic thing could be useful to have a bunch of Lotus Petals laying around for, then it puts you in a really good spot.
Right, yep. Yeah. Yeah, if you can find a place to take advantage of those. By the way, Marionette Master has been brought up quite a bit with this guy, so I just want to read that card. It's 6 mana, 4 black for a human artificer. It's a 1/3, and it has Fabricate 3. So you can put, you know, 3 colorless servos into play or put 3 counters on it. Whenever an artifact you control is put into a graveyard from the battlefield, target opponent loses life equal to its power. So that's pretty damn good with Marionette Master and Revel in Riches as both, you know, the other part of a win condition in a deck. And they just happen to be in the same color scheme. So
yeah.
I would agree that that would work out pretty well. I could see, you know, this is the ideal way to take advantage of this card in Standard. However, it is quite mana costly.
Yeah, I mean, you could play like a Jund ramp deck. Where there's like a 3 mana ramp spell, and then there's Hour of Promise mm-hmm. and Chefnet Monitor. So you have like all these things that can ramp to get you to Revel in Riches and Brass's mm-hmm. what is Brass's Horde, Brass's Bounty,
Brass's Bounty. Yeah.
I was like Brass's Horde, Brass's Pile, Brass's Treasure, can't remember what it's called. That can get you to Brass's Bounty quicker and like have it all be lands because they put lands to play tapped. And it can also give you, you know, Marionette Master on turn 5 or something like that, or turn 4. So, I mean, this is like realistically possible stuff. But you do have to, you know, play some Fatal Pushes and some, you know, Sweltering Suns or whatever generic removal spells that you have to play to make sure you don't die before this stuff happens.
Yeah, yeah, and this can be like your only, you know, your only win conditions in the deck too. However, you know, like, so Reveling Riches gets you treasure tokens. If the deck's plan is to get treasure tokens, you're likely going to be able to ramp with those treasure tokens, right?
Yeah.
So not just Reveling Riches, but I mean, there have got to be other applications that, like Treasure Map, for example, spits out 3 treasure tokens, and it can leverage those into card advantage too.
Yeah.
So,
and I mean, and it just lets you leverage, like, you let you create a mana advantage. So you can play X spells, you can play big planeswalkers, you can play big, like, big expensive cards. If you can generate this mana advantage using, like, the green cards, the Shepnut Monitors, and the Hour of Promises, and the treasure tokens, you just need to find some solid mana sinks.
Yep. Yeah, so I think this, I would argue that this is fundamentally different than Boundless Realms, even though at first glance it would appear to be similar, because I don't think the appeal here is really getting all that mana as much as it is getting all those artifacts that can be, you know,
I was just about to say, Duretti and various generic red artifact EDHs are going to be very excited about this card.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
All right, cool. Well, we talked about all of the other spoilers so far. They're just slowly coming out. So stay tuned. I'm sure we'll have more next week. I don't know when the official spoiler week starts. It's probably not for a bit now. Do you know?
No clue.
Okay. No, I shouldn't be admitting that. I need to know these things.
I know. You're the host. I'm just the guy that plays along. Really, I should also try and know these things, but I've been next deep in work, so yeah.
All right, well, we're going to reach the bulk of our episode here now, and we're going to jump into Modern. Karnak Life is supported by The Discard. Visit thediscard.com for a variety of Magic content, including news, set reviews, limited, and constructed strategy. Interested in playing Constructed without the painful cost of digital objects and steep loss in value at rotation? Our friends at ManaTraders.com offer a subscription rental service allowing the rental of up to 1,250 tickets worth of cards in Standard, Modern, Legacy, Commander, Pauper, or Vintage. Give them a shot at ManaTraders.com and tell them we sent you by entering this month's promo code CKL at checkout for 7% off your subscription for the first 5 months. Let me just preface this by saying that Brad Nelson recently came out with an article on Star City Games Premium about Modern and his experiences in Modern recently, called In Search of Modern's Current Best Deck. And in this article, he ranks the top 20 Modern decks, according to him. Admittedly, you know, rather subjective, not suggestive. Based on his own experiences. But we're going to attempt first, before even looking at Brad Nelson's list, to share our own top 10, not top 20, but we're going to do our own top 10 and see how different or similar they may end up being. So I'm curious, Daryl, should we start at the end and work our way up?
However you like to do it.
Let's do it. Let's start at number 10. What's your number 10? And I should also say this, not necessarily the most powerful decks in the format, but say, imagine you are a very competitive player looking to take down a GP. You may not have tons of experience in Modern, or you may, but you're trying to pick the deck that has the biggest chance, the best competitive advantage, we'll put it that way. The best competitive advantage, given the current meta and the current results. So, yep. What is your number 10?
My number 10 is Jeskai Geist. Okay. You're going to see a big, big theme with all of the decks that I'm going to put out here. You would rather be the hunter than the hunted. Like, you would rather be the person who is trying to beat people than who is going to be trying to react.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is probably either the most or second most reactive deck on my list here, and you're still just trying to play Geist of Saint Track and Remands and Logic Knots and Lightning Helixes and just Spell Quellers and just kill your opponent.
Yeah.
But white, you know, where Modern sits now, white has all of the most powerful generic sideboard cards and, you know, Rest in Peace of Stony Silence and Leyline of Sanctity. So you have, like, the most generically powerful white cards. If you play a bunch of basics, you get the most generically powerful red sideboard card against the big mana decks, which is Blood Moon. And you have a clock in Spell Queller and Geist of Saint Traff that can attack the aggressive decks. And so it's just, well, how do you put together your card advantage for your Jeskai Geist deck? Are you playing Serum Visions? Are you playing Opt? Are you playing Search for Ascanta? Are you playing Electrolyzes? You know, what cantrips are you playing? Are you playing Remands to push your way through your deck to continue to leverage your advantage? And then you still have the the sort of standard blue-white control version of, I have colonnades, so that if this game goes kind of long and you try and run me out of threats, I have these 4/4s.
Uh-huh.
So, but you do have just one of the hardest to interact with threats in modern, which is Geist of St. Draft. Like, there's one edict that I know of that's going around and kicking around, and that's Liliana the Veil. Otherwise, you have to put a body in front of it. And with a pile of Path to Exiles, Lightning Bolts, and Lightning Helixes, guess what's not going to live very long? Your opponent's creatures. So you just play this guy on turn 3, and you give them one turn to resolve a Liliana. Otherwise, you have Paths and Bolts to kill their Bobs and their Tarmogoyfs and their Merfolk and their, you know, light goblin guides or Eidolon the Great Immortals or whatever generic things they can put in front of it and just go to beat downtown. And then you just have, like, the generic counter spells to interact with all of your combo decks that are trying to just do unfair things, too. So I feel like the between all of the clocking plus the, you know, soft interruptions you can give your opponents in game one and then the generically powerful sideboard cards that you can get in games two and three, I think this is a pretty well-positioned and probably one of the most reactive decks on this that I have.
Yeah, yeah. I'll tell you mine, but before I do, I have to say that this was incredibly difficult to do. Modern is so vast that you can play 100 games and you can completely, I mean, you cannot see one deck, you know, included in Brad's list of top 20. And that's extremely likely, particularly when you're looking online or going to an FNM or whatever that may be. But there are just so many decks out there that to have the experience of how each one of those variables interacts with one another is something that no one can say that they have really completely understood. So for someone that plays Grixis Death Shadow to comment on, you know, Blue Tron's matchup against Affinity, it's like you can hypothesize, but until you've actually played it out, it's really difficult to say, you know, how that's going to be, right?
Yeah.
So my top 10 is kind of based on what types of strategies I deem, like, in this environment to be effective. And my number 10 is probably one that's not on a lot of people's lists, but I would argue that 8-Rack is pretty strong right now. And I hate to say it, I absolutely hate playing against 8-Rack. I think it's an awful, poisonous deck for the format. But if I'm going to be playing a deck that has reactive or removal type of strategies, I'm going to want to do it before they even have a chance to cast those things. I suppose you would call that proactive. So turn one, Thoughtseize remains one of the most powerful plays in the format.
So I look at 8-Rack like a combo deck.
Yeah.
Like your combo is, you know, 30 redundant cards that make your opponent discard its cards, and 8-Racks.
Yeah.
You know, and 22 lands. So, like, did you draw the most important combo piece, which is the rack, or Shrieking Affliction, which is why it's called 8-Rack. And if you drew the most important combo piece, all the rest of your deck is so redundant that it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So, like, the one thing that I did consider when I was looking at these decks is, like, you know, a lot of my decks are very aggressive. Some of them are combo decks. Some of them are aggressive, just beatdown strategies. But one thing that I truly took a look at is, like, I don't want to have a giant fail rate. So I don't want to have games where I just lose to not drawing A plus B.
Uh-huh.
And, like, some of these decks that I've got on this list, you know, do have that as an option, that you can just, like, have this fail rate.
Yeah.
But the payoff for the things that have that fail rate are pretty high.
Yeah. So are you considering 8-Rack to have a high fail rate if they don't draw their racks?
Yeah, it feels like an abysmally high fail rate if you don't draw the rack. Because, like, you could just play a game against, like, a generic blue control deck where you don't draw the rack, and they just sit with negates in their hand. Or, like, they draw a Cryptic Command, mm-hmm. and you're just both top decking, and then they counter your discard spell that you're going to hit the Cryptic Command with, and cantrip, and, like, start to dig themselves out of the, you know, the hole that you put them in with the discard.
Yeah.
And then if they just draw, like, a Planeswalker, like a generic Gideon or Jace or something like that, or even a Liliana, they're going to pull ahead of you because now you don't have anything because you can't beat the top of their deck and you didn't draw your finisher.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree with that it's there's a high risk factor in playing such a deck. I think that's true for a lot of the decks in Modern based on, you know, a combo. And you're right, this is a combo deck in a way. It's a combination of you having no cards in your hand and me having a rack in play, you know. Including cards like Ensnaring Bridge in these types of decks, though, buys you a lot of time, particularly in the main deck. Well, a lot of these ones run like one Ensnaring Bridge in the main deck. That's the type of card that can just completely shut out aggressive creature decks, which is the biggest detriment to not drawing one of your racks.
Well, it's not even aggressive creature decks that it can shut out. It can shut out just whole swaths of the meta trying to attack, because, like, you know, you're going to play all your discard spells and you're going to have a Liliana and a bridge and you're just going to have nothing in your hand.
Right.
So, like, anybody trying to attack you with anything is going to not really be getting anywhere.
Yeah. Now, going back to the point I made before mentioning 8-Rack, I would anticipate that a difficult matchup for this deck is the, like, Grixis Death Shadow decks, based on the fact that putting a lot of cards in their graveyard can allow for some of the big dredge creatures to come out. However, Liliana the Veil is pretty good against those situations, as is Smallpox. The decks don't play a ton of creatures. There's not a lot out there that I could see being a total, like, 8-Rack is just a dog in this matchup. But maybe I'm not thinking of something. Is there something out there? I'm not an 8-Rack player by any means.
So I'm not an 8-Rack player, but I've played against it a lot with blue-white control. If you can just generically put a card advantage engine in play, like something that stays in play, and generates you some sort of card advantage, whether that be, you know, actually drawing physical cards, or just doing something, like, then your 8-Rack opponent will lose.
Are you insinuating Search for Ezcanto?
No, I'm insinuating a Planeswalker, or like Karanos, or something like any generic thing that generates you some sort of advantage when activated, that is just a permanent that sits in play.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, 8-Rack struggles with non-creature permanents. So, like, if you can put a generic non-creature permanent into play, they're probably going to have a hard time beating it.
Yeah, Search for Ezcanto is probably actually a good choice because it's cheap enough to play before it gets stripped.
Yeah, but, like, I've also played games where I've just, like, played the 5-color Glittering Wish control deck against that deck and, like, top deck Glittering Wish and just wished for Karanos and put it into play, and my opponent could never win.
Yeah,
like, they're just like, all right, I get lightning bolted until I die and hope you never, like, hold a card so that my rack can maybe kill you. But, like, as far as, like, this list is concerned, you're asking, you know, what are good decks for people? You know, you may not be a Modern Master, you may not know the intricacies of every bit of the matchups. This is a really straightforward deck. You point the boomstick of discard at your opponent's face, and you click. And then you play a thing that says, you die, because I pointed and clicked. Like, it's pretty straightforward. It's a pretty easy one to pick up and understand. It's just sometimes you do have to figure out what hands do you want to keep against what decks.
Sure.
And how do you sideboard this monstrosity of a pile of discard spells and removal. So, But, like, I agree this is a very good one for, like, just, like, point click. Like, if I'm going to pick it up, this is not a bad one.
Yeah. All right. For the record, Brad's 10th deck is Eldrazi Tron. He's pretty high on pretty high on Tron, as he explains in the article. Basically is saying that turn 3 Karn is very powerful right now. There's not a lot of Blood Moon out there based on the need for other types of sideboard pieces due to, like, Grixis Death Shadow being very good.
Sure.
Some of the hardest matchups for Tron-style decks are no longer super present in the format because Grixis Death Shadow has pushed them out of the format as it has Storm Gifts. So Tron is a good place to be right now. He doesn't really speak specifically to Eldrazi Tron, but spoiler alert, the other Tron is on the list as well.
Sure.
So let's jump ahead. Let's keep going. Number 9. What's your number 9?
Generic discard Tarmogoyf dot deck.
Okay.
I put Jund and Abzan on the same level. You could put Sultai there too. It's just generic, like, Thoughtseize plus Dark Confidant or Tarmogoyf or Grim Flayer, the deck.
Yeah.
Like, you have the same, you know, 15 to 18 easy cards kind of at the beginning, which is 4 Thoughtseize, you know, or 4 Inquisition, 2-3 Thoughtseize, 4 Liliana, 4 Tarmogoyf, and, like, 2 Scavenging Ooze, and then, like, Abrupt Decays or Fatal Pushes, or, like, you fill it in with whatever generic cards you think are relevant in the meta. It's one of those decks that there's some intricacies and there's some play to it. Each generic collection of colors has its own upside. You know, Abzan gives you Gideon and Lingering Souls and the powerful white sideboard cards. Red gives you Kolaghan's Command and Lightning Bolt to close games faster, and Crumble to Dust and Blood Moon if you're so crazy. Sultai lets you play like this interesting Traverse the Human Wall package is what I've seen for Sultai decks.
Yeah.
Where you have a bunch of powerful blue and black creatures. Like, you can play Vendilion Click or Glenlander Archmage, or you know, you get counter spells, you get counter spells so that you can interact with your opponent. And you can top end with things like the Scare of God, you know, if you can make the game go long enough. But generic Thoughtseize plus Tarmogoyf beatdown clock is just a very powerful, like, tried and true 50-50 strategy. There are some really bad matchups. Any of the big mana matchups are really rough. Like Tron, you have to get the perfect, like, discard Tarmogoyf Liliana beatdown strategy to hand. Because if you're trying to, like, clock your opponent with Dark Confidant, you're just going to get carned. But if you can get them with Tarmogoyfs, then you might be able to race.
Yeah, that's an interesting choice, Daryl, because I think we for the longest time, modern players would agree that Abzan and Jund are always a safe choice. They're always a strong choice. In the hands of an experienced player, playing decks with Thoughtseize in them and Liliana of the Veil are always strong. Brad is one of those players. He's kind of known for playing those types of decks. And in his article, he specifically stated this. I'm going to read this right from his article. Yeah.
Sure.
Speaking of Jund, it's not on my list. I'm done with midrange. I have always treated the format as a puzzle to solve, which is why I gravitated towards decks like this for so many years, but that time is over. These decks aren't good. They are serviceable for those who want to play them, but they've become worse versions of other mid-range decks like Grixis Death Shadow and Eldrazi Tron. It would take an extreme metagame shift for me to believe that Abzan or Jund were good choices, but until then, I believe these decks always feel fine, but never actually good.
So, and that's exactly how I feel about what I was saying about Jund. Generic discard Tarmogoyf deck. And that's why, like, when I said it, there's even that air of, whatever. It's like generic discard spells and Tarmogoyf.
Yeah, yeah.
They get the job done and they're 50-50, but, like none of the other random decks that are out there. You did have a deck on your list that I probably would have, if I thought of it, would have put on my list over Jund and Abzan.
Okay,
but it was just like, I'm not going to spoil it for the people at home. But yeah, just fine. Generic discard plus Tarmogoyf deck is just, it's mediocre and it gets the job done, but like it doesn't excite me.
Yeah, and I don't mean to say that to like say you're wrong, because I'm just reading what Brad says. I don't necessarily agree with him, you know, and I don't disagree with him either. I would agree that they're probably pretty mediocre at this point, but I think that there's always something to be said about, you know, having the option to pick apart an opposing combo deck with like Thoughtseize.
Yeah, like, it's one of those things that, you know, it doesn't take a meta master to play Jund and Abzan.
Yeah.
It does to construct your sideboard correctly, but, like, if you've got access to the expensive cards in this deck, and you're just like, I'm going to play Jund, I would be like, yeah, I don't blame you for playing Jund. Deck's fine. Like,
yeah.
If you have access to the cards, play them. If you don't. Like,
it plays some of the most powerful and the most valuable cards in the format, but it doesn't play a combo. And it doesn't have that option to have, you know, this other way to win the game if shit hits the fan, you know? And, like, cards, or decks like Collected Company have those options. And not just the Abzan Coco, but, like, the Bant Coco as well has the Nightfall combo. And so when things are going bad, when things are going well, you can be a mid-range deck. You can play the powerful creatures on, you know, for cheap costs. You can Coco into two, like, powerful 3-drops. Or when things are going poorly and you just draw a Coco off the top of your deck, you've got nothing going for you, you can find Devoted Druid and Vizier of Remedies or some pieces to locate them.
Yeah.
And you've got that out. So I would argue that those decks are just hands down better mid-range decks at this point. And he brings up Grixis Death Shadow and Eldrazi Tron. You know, obviously those have similar axes. And
they're not really mid-range decks, but I can see what he's saying, yeah.
Yeah. His number 9, by the way. I should hop back.
What about your number 9?
Oh, I didn't do my number 9. Yeah, I got excited about yours. Eldrazi and Taxes is my number 9. Specifically Eldrazi and Taxes, but I think you could probably lump in all of the Hate Bears decks there.
I'd say generic white-green Hate Bears, white-black Hate Bears, mostly, the deck.
I think that this deck, based on the need to just have answers to a lot of things, it has a lot of diverse lines that you can play. And it takes a knowledgeable pilot, but if you know the meta and you know the contents of your opponent's deck, playing Eldrazi and Tactus can be a great way to, you know, just put the lock on whatever specific strategy they're trying to attempt. And it plays effective creatures that can be cast ridiculously cheaply.
So here's the thing. You're trying to treat this deck like a beatdown deck. And it is a beatdown deck at its core, but it just has an I win combo in it.
Yeah, Leon and Arbiter, or what?
No, Displacer plus Thoughtnotseer.
Oh, sure.
You just blink it on their draw step, and you can basically Fate Seal your opponent. Make sure they never draw a relevant spell, unless it's an instant speed spell that they can interact with you with.
Right.
So if you can put a second Displacer in play, at that point, like, you have the hard lock, because they can't kill your Displacers, and you can continue to check their hand with Thoughtnotseer. And you can stack the triggers so that they draw their extra card, and then you look at their hand. And you can just make sure that they never draw a relevant card and just have lands in there.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, having this I win button that you can also just attack for 10 with or whatever is extremely, like, or attack for 7 and close the game quickly is a very relevant thing to have.
Not to mention, we have access to some of the most powerful sideboard cards in Modern in white. You know, white's the best sideboard color. Black and white is debatably the best combination of colors you can have.
Yeah, absolutely.
And in our main deck, we have plenty of ways to deal with lands, which is extremely relevant right now.
Field of Ruin and Ghost Quarter and Leonid Arbiter, all great. Yeah, like, I like this deck. It's one of the couple decks, I didn't think of that deck. But, yeah, I could see, like, if you feel comfortable sometimes losing, because your mana base does have a fail rate. That's one of my problems with this deck is, like, you don't draw Aether Vial. Your mana base does have a fail rate, so be careful. Like, you're kind of subjecting yourself to that.
Yeah.
So, like, you want to avoid the like, very obvious fail rate of drawing, like, Temple, Ghost Quarter, and no colored sources, because you do have so many colorless lands. And, like, you could argue, well, all mana bases have a fail rate. Yeah, but, like, a Jund mana base, you're much less likely to color screw yourself with Jund or Jeskai than you are with a deck with, you know, 12 colorless lands in it.
Right, yeah. Yeah, it's definitely vulnerable. It's got moments where the deck loses to itself because it doesn't draw the right tools or draws them in the wrong order, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, I try to take, like, so being an interactive deck, order does matter, but, like, the fail rate I'm talking about is just, like, if you're trying to combo, you know, having a situation where your deck is all A's and not enough B's, that's, like, 8-Rack has that fail rate. And, like, your mana base just kind of blowing up in your face. Like, Eldrazi does have that fail rate. But, like, there are ways that you can, like, smooth over those fail rates. Like, having a bunch of cantrips or having search cards to, like, so you can smooth over the fail rates. Or having just so many A's that you're so likely to draw one. And if you, like, you know, if you have 15 cards that are just mega powerful, you probably have one in your opener. And if you just didn't draw one, you got really unlucky. Because, like, the math says you should always draw one. Theoretically.
Yeah. All right. Brad's number 9, and I won't go into too much detail because, I mean, go read the article if you want to know. His number 9 is Titan Shift, and basically citing that it's just in a good place in the meta right now.
Yeah.
All right. Shall we go to number 8, Daryl?
Yeah. I have Affinity.
You do? Okay.
I have tiny artifact beatdown creatures. Mostly just because it has one of the most powerful cards in the meta in Mox Opal.
Yep.
To get you to 2 mana on turn 1. And you just have so many generically powerful cards that kill your opponent. Like, putting 5 permanents into play on turn 1, one of them being a Signal Pest or a Steel Overseer or an Arcbound Ravager or a Cranial Plating, like, just putting a pile of stuff into play, makes it pretty damn hard for your opponent to win the game.
Yeah.
And then, like, you have Galvanic Blast to close. You have Edge Champion if the games go long and you're interacting with removal or blockers. You have 8 man lands, which is huge to give you mana sinks to do when you're top decking to go with your Cranial Platings. Or you can, if your Ravagers die, you can hide counters on your man lands so that you have this, like, very hard to kill threat that they have to have an instant speed removal spell for. Like, there's a lot to like in Affinity. And because it's a 5-color deck with all the Rainbow Lands and Springleaf Drums, you can just play the best sideboard cards. Now, the problem is that, like, you are susceptible to one of the most played sideboard cards in Modern, which is, or 2 of them, or 3 of them, which are, like, Stony Silence, Shatterstorm, and Kolaghan's Command. Like, you're very susceptible to those cards. But, like, you can come out the gate, and most of the time you beat the brakes off of your opponent game one. So your opponent has to draw enough sideboard cards to not lose games two and three. And even then, if you lose game two and you're on the play for game three, you can just beat the brakes off of your opponent in game three before they get their sideboard card in play. Like, you can equip your creature with a cranial plating before they can play their Stony Silence, and then you just beat the brakes off of them with your, you know, 6/2 Ornithopter, or your, you know, your Master of Ethereum, or your Etch Champion, or whatever.
Yeah, either that or you're just like, well, you know, I've got Aether Grid.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I'm saying. You get to play the best sideboard cards. You have this functional, like, your Snapcasters or your Lingering Souls or whatever never live, and then otherwise I'm just going to go face and kill you. You have to kill all of my permanents.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, Affinity goes tall, it goes wide, it goes infect, it does, yeah, it has some crucial pieces of the deck that are just hosers for other strategies. There are plenty of decks that just can't beat a Resolved Etch Champion. Yeah. Because no matter what, you're never going to get them off Metalcraft, and that thing is just going to consistently beat you in the face until you're dead.
Yeah, and the great part about this is it's a super powerful deck for new players and modern to pick up and just grab and go. And then the Masters of Affinity, there's so much functional math and how to squeeze points out of your Arcbound Ravagers and your Signal Pests and when to activate your mainlands and attack and how to use your Steel Overseers. And just there's like so many small minutia percentage points that you can get. Like, when is it okay to move your second Springleaf Drum in onto your Arcbound Ravager? Or how many, you know, how do you manage your cranial plates and your ravagers? Like, there's so many intricate details that there's the Affinity Masters just, it feels so unbeatable.
Yeah.
When they get into those positions.
Yeah, good, right. All right. My number eight is Dredge. I still think Dredge is good.
This is the deck I forgot about.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have, which makes it even better.
Like, if I would have remembered Dredge was a deck, I certainly would not have put, like, Jeskai Geist or Abzan on my list. Damn. I would have been like, oh, yeah, Dredge, flip your deck over, conflagrate your opponent, put some 3/3s into play, and laugh.
Yeah.
Like you should beat the brakes off of your opponent and win most of your game once, unless they're playing, like, a super aggressive deck that you can't race.
Yep.
Because you just outgrind all the mid-range decks. You might not be able to race the combo decks. It just depends on if you get the, like, Dredge heavy draw and you draw Cathartic Reunion. Right. But
now there are ways to deal with Dredge, but yeah, it's just absolutely so damn fast that even a Rest in Peace sometimes is too late.
Yeah, know? Sometimes Rest in Peace on turn two doesn't do it, because on turn one they have the, like, the Dredge guy and they dredge and put, like, the Narcomoeba and two of the 3/3s in play, and you're just like, well, my Rest in Peace doesn't do anything.
That's right, yeah. If you're too late with your Rest in Peace, you're taking a turn off to cast a Rest in Peace while they have, you know, another 7 damage coming your way.
Yes, 4 to 7 damage coming, so, 5 to 7 damage, yeah. So, yeah, yes, so it's just crazy.
That card is difficult for them to beat, but even with that drawback, just like Affinity has the same kinds of drawbacks, it's just so powerful without it. There are plenty of decks that just hands down cannot deal with Dredge. They have no way of beating it.
And
I've played some of those decks, and my plan is just to not see it.
And so the key here is, like, Dredge plays Faithless Looting and Cathartic Reunion, yep, and Collective Brutality. They can sideboard in Hollowed Ones and go on that plan as well. Kind of like the Dredge decks do in Vintage, where they activate Bazaar and then play Hollowed Ones while you have your Leyline Void in play, and they just don't care. So, like, that's also a plan you can have as a Dredge player.
Wow, yeah, I haven't seen that.
And you can also just put, like, I haven't seen it yet, but it's just, like, a very functional sideboard strategy from, like, Vintage. Bizarre, they let you discard 3 cards, which make Hollowed One free. You know, in this case, Faithless Looting or Cathartic Union discard you 2 cards, make your Hollowed Ones cost 1. But, like, that's very much a reasonable strategy that you could play.
Yeah.
Especially when you have, like, Life in the Loam with just a bunch of extra cards to discard. You know, your opponents have to be able to draw their sideboard cards, and it's not like you can't play a bunch of anti-hate, like Ancient Grudges and Nature's Claims and Abrupt Decays and just, like, blow all their sideboard cards off the table. So, like, these are all things you can do that people are like, yeah, I'll just draw my sideboard card against Dredge. Like, now you got to have, like, 5 of them, and you probably got to draw 2. Because, like, they'll kill the first one, and then you just got to – then they'll try and move in, and you got to play the second one and hope it's good enough.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Let's go on here. Brad's eighth deck is Connor's Company.
Okay.
So we'll talk about that one later.
Yeah.
Number seven.
I got generic three damage spells the deck. I got burn.
You do? Okay.
Yeah. I mean, like, people don't play real life game in modern anymore. Like, they just, you know, Sphinx's Revelation is not real life game. People aren't playing timely reinforcements. They do have white ley line in some decks, very few.
Yeah.
But, like, people aren't playing Core Firewalker, Burrington Forge Tender. You know, there's no chill. People are trying to fight with, like, blue counterspells or race. Like, please, give me Grixis Death Shadow against Burn. You'll go to 13, and then I'll just start lobbing lava spikes at your face. Like, please, I will gladly do that. And, like, if Grixis Death Shadow is the best deck, which some people think it is, if they're going to start the game at 13, I only got to draw four cards to kill you. Like, okay.
Yeah, like, yeah, that's true.
I'm in. Like, plus, Eidolon of the Great Rebel is just a very difficult magic card for most card decks in Modern to beat. They're definitely taking two damage off of it, if not more. So, like, as you know, as boring as it is, generic lava spikes the deck is pretty exciting. Plus, if you can convince yourself to go down to two colors instead of playing three, you could splash Blood Moon and just be like, oh, big mana deck, Blood Moon, go. like you can have that top end while you're playing Eidolon of the Great Rebels.
Not many people do, but you could.
Yeah, I mean, it's an option if you really just want, if you really think that the big mana decks are the best decks in the format. You're just like, all right, I'm never going to lose to them. Here's four Blood Moons. Or you can play four Molten Rains and, like, deal two damage to them and kill their like, Green Source or their Valakut or whatever. Or their Tron Land. So, but I think just, like, being the aggressor and setting the tone of the match is very important right now in Modern.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I don't have Burn on my list. And it might be biased because a lot of the decks I play have a good Burn matchup. I never feel like it's a difficult matchup. Because the plan against it, no matter what I'm playing, is almost always the same. It's survive long enough to establish a board presence and run them out of cards. So that they're in the top deck mode. And I think that understanding how to play Burn helps you to beat Burn. Unfortunately, there are a lot of people that play too aggressively or too recklessly against it, and they just put themselves in situations where they die.
Yeah.
But,
I mean, you know, yeah, but they're...
Daryl, you brought up Grixis Death Shadow as an example, and yeah, right, so like you're going to shock yourself down to 13 in that deck frequently, but against Burn, you can't do that. You got to know not to do that, right? You got to be careful. Yeah. You have to hold back your street rates and things like that.
But sometimes
if you can let them do the work, though, then you play the Death Shadows and you beat them down.
Yeah. Yeah, the problem is sometimes you just don't know. So like there are a lot of game ones for Burn against Death Shadow where they might like cycle street race, shock, fetch, Thoughtseize. And go to 13, and then they're like, damn, four lava spikes. I'm dead.
Fair enough. I mean, you're on the play. If you're on the play, that could be the case. But on the draw, Burn's going to do something on turn one, or they should have mulliganed, you know? Like, you know they're on Burn because they've played a Goblin Guide, or they've played a lava spike or something.
Sure. Absolutely. And I think that, like, there are just some games where your Burn opponent just goes, like, Goblin Guide, Swift Spear, Bolt you, attack you for seven, you know, take seven on turn two, and you're already at 11, and there's just nothing you can do about it.
Yeah.
Like, there are those games, too, where, you know, like, you might have things, but they're just not fast enough.
Sure. Okay.
So, like, there are definitely free wins for Burn.
Yeah, yeah. Collective Brutality is good against Burn.
It is. It's very good.
That gets played a lot.
Yeah.
You didn't mention that one, but I thought I'd bring it up. Anyways.
Yeah, that is.
Going on, number seven. My number seven is Humans. Affinity is a versatile tribal deck, quote unquote, tribal robots. Humans is another very versatile tribal deck. It's got a lot of ways built into the tribe that deal a lot of ways to deal with the biggest problems that the deck can face. Be it like Supreme Verdict, you know, we've got Meddling Mage and we've got Kite Sail Freebooter. And also just generally against the control decks, which typically would be the biggest problems for this creature based deck because they're, you know, all their removal spells are being pointed at your creatures. We've got both Thalias. Both Thalias are quite good in those types of matchups.
Yes, they are.
I stopped playing blue white control because this Humans matchup was just so abysmal. I couldn't handle it.
So the Humans matchup is fine if you split your Wrath of Gods.
That's what I've heard, and I still don't believe it.
But
go ahead, finish that thought.
Sure. So, like, I was playing I've been playing against the Humans matchup, and it's felt like kind of 60-40. You have, like, Path to Exiles, which I can shut off with Meddling Mage or Freebooter. You know, I have two Supreme Verdict, one Wrath, one Settle the Wreckage. So you have a three Wrath split. so they can try and name two and still get got by the third. I also played Porphyry Nodes, which is a really good extra one mana removal spell against them. Yeah. But I mean, and so, and it depends on if you're playing Rune Halo's like main board, stuff like that. Because between Rune Halo, Spreading Seas, and Field of Ruin targeting their Rainbow Lands, Detention Sphere, Path, Supreme Verdict, Settle the Wreckage, Wrath of God, and then just like the generic Gideon package, you have a lot of stuff to interact with your opponent. Like, you're not ever really want for interaction. The problem is like, if you draw your clunky interaction and they play two mana Thalia,
yeah,
then you're in a world of hurt. Like, yes. That's where you're just like, damn it, I don't want to be alive anymore. Like, it feels horrible, and I'm sad, and everything is awful. Like, when you draw your Cryptic Commands against Thalia Guardian Threeman, you just want to throw your deck across the room.
There are many times where I'm betting on the Supreme Verdict in my hand, and just on turn three, before I can cast the damn thing, Thalia shows up, and I don't have the fifth land.
Thalia, attack you, Manus Rider, attack you.
Yeah, Mana Mage.
That's super fun. Feels real bad, but yeah, like Thalia is a big thorn in the control deck side. But yeah, like humans is just a very strong. You got 12 anti combo cards. You got some flyers. You got Champion of the Parish that's out of control large. Like you've got Dark Confidant and Necromancer for the combo deck or for the control decks. I don't really know how you beat the aggro decks. Like, you guys just get bigger, I guess. I don't actually. Yes. I've never played humans. Oh, you have Thalia's Lieutenant. That's how. You have Thalia's Lieutenant. You have Gavity Township on a dude. Got it.
Yeah, Mantis Rider is a fine blocker, too. And flying helps.
Yeah. Plus, you flip Mayor of Avernbrook, you make a bunch of wolves. Okay, this seems way better than I thought it was. Like,
It's very versatile, surprisingly so.
Yeah, fam. Like, totally would play, but I'm poor and don't own enough Thalias.
Here's the first time we actually agree on something here. Brad's got humans at 7 as well. So, we're up. We've talked about...
I think we've got some decks on Brad's list, just not in the same order as Brad.
Yeah.
It's possible. Right, number 6.
Yeah, his 7 is humans. You're number 6. Go ahead.
Ad Nauseam.
Okay.
So, this is that deck that I kind of talked about earlier that has a really high fail rate because you only have 4 Bs in Ad Nauseam. But, like, the payoff is you just actually win the game. Like, it's not A plus B and then, like, Grishul Brain where you, like, hit the Gristle twice, draw Shoal plus Worm, and you're, like, soft to, like, Graveyard Hate. This is just, like, A plus B is you're dead.
Yeah.
And there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it.
Yeah, fair enough.
It's super resilient because it's a bunch of cantrips. You can go super fast and kill them on turn 3. You have Boseiju out of the sideboard to prevent them from nonsense, to like keep them from countering your things. You have Ley Lines against discard. You have Echoing Truth against the hate permanents. Like, you have all the things. And then sometimes you might just have, like, the sideboard plan to board in some Grave Titans. Like, use your Lotus Blue on turn 3 to make a Grave Titan.
Right.
And that should be good enough, because they're not going to keep Path to Exile against you. You have the multiple different win conditions. You have Slaughter Pack to kill the first Battling Mage main board. Like, I feel like you can just kind of... Like, this is that deck that has an extremely high fail rate, but it's just so resilient if you're not doing very specific things.
Fair. That one is not on my list. I don't know. I think that the extremely high fail rate paired with the less explosive combo potential than the other decks that we've talked about and with similar circumstances makes it not as appealing for me, but I can see your points.
Yeah.
My number 6 similarly has, you know, an explosive combo and maybe a similar fail rate to Ad Nauseam, but I think that this one does a lot more outside of that, and that's Scapeshift. I think Scapeshift is really strong.
So I think the fail rate depends on the build.
Sure. Are you talking about for Scapeshift or for Ad Nauseam?
For Scapeshift. For Scapeshift.
Okay. Yeah. There are lots of different versions of this deck. So I specifically am talking about like Titan Shift.
So it also just depends on the build of Titan Shift.
Okay.
So if it's Titan Shift with Hour of Promise, the fail rate is much lower.
Okay.
Because then you have more Primeval Titan effects. Because Hour of Promise just goes and gets two lands. You just put Valakuts into play. And then you can just, like, slow roll by playing lands and, like, your Farseeks are Lightning Bolts now.
Uh-huh.
But if you're not playing Hour of Promise and you're just, like, all in on Summoner's Pact or maybe playing Through the Breach or something like that, then your fail rate's much higher because you don't have as much consistency of getting Valakut into play.
Okay. Yeah, I get that. I don't know. I think Scapeshift is included on here for obvious reasons, being that it's kind of like it feels like a one card combo when you're doing the Scapeshift versions.
Yeah, it is.
Or when you're casting Scapeshift for the win.
And when you're casting Primeval Titan, your opponent's basically dead. Like it's not like you casted Primeval Titan, resolved the trigger, and then like your opponent's got some outs. Like if you weren't dead before you resolved the Primeval Titan, your opponent's just probably gonna lose. Right, like you're going to untap, and you're going to break your Sakura Tribe Elder and deal 6 to them, and play a fetch land and deal 6 to them, and cast Farseek and deal 6 to them. Or you're just going to attack them with Primeval Titan, and they're just dead.
Yeah.
So, like the payoff spells are, like, non-zero amount of powerful. You do have some weird fail rates if you're not very careful with your Summoner's Packs. People can, like, spread and seize your lands, or bounce them to Cryptic Command, or, like, Fulminator Mage them and, like, make you lose the game to your own pact. So, like, be very careful with those matchups. Game ones especially, because most people don't play around it. But definitely in game twos, like, make sure that you don't put yourself in a spot where, like, your green source gets Fulminator Maged and you have no way to, like, pay for your pact. Because then you're just losing games that you were, like, pretty far ahead in.
Yeah.
And you just don't want to do that.
Yeah, Cryptic Command, Counter the Spell, Bounce the Land, and then start another one on your turn.
Yeah, like,
I have one in situations like that, and it feels really good.
Yeah, so I've done that too. Spreading Seizure Land on turn 3, and they played a pact for Wood Elves, and played Wood Elves to get a second forest, and then Cryptic their forest.
Yeah.
And, like, passed in Tectonic Edge or other land. It's just like, yeah, this is what's up. Take that!
Now, there is, like, the inevitability of drawing all the lands and just dealing them all the damage with Valakut and just playing mountains.
Absolutely.
But the combo piece that you really need to see is Scapeshift in this one. But when you have the Titan Shift version, you know, there's that other way to win that is a totally separate, that is a way totally separate
from anything grindy. Related to it's lands. It's much grindier. You have Titans. Like, it's all kind of related to lands. But the Titan part makes your deck very grindy.
Well, I'm thinking, like, put Emrakul into play or something. But even just attacking with the Titan usually sets
If you're playing Breach. Yeah, if you're playing Breach or, like, Summoner's Trap, and you have these, like, extra cards, typically they just have Green Sun or Green Pact bullets, like Hornet Queen and, like, Carnage Tyrant is the one I've seen recently. It's, like, against the control decks, you just board in Carnage Tyrant, and you're just like, here's a 7/6, Hexproof Trample, go. And make them try and figure out how the hell to beat that card, which, by the way, I played against it a bunch. It's literally impossible.
Damn.
Like, I chained Cryptic Commands for, like, 5 turns and then still couldn't beat the stupid thing. It's so annoying. Yeah.
Yeah. There's Supreme Verdict in the format, though. You know, I mean, you got stuff.
Yeah. You board that stuff out usually against Titan Shift, but yeah.
Oh, right. Against Titan Shift, yes. Is that where you're seeing it?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought you meant, like, in general, but I get you.
No, yeah, definitely out of Titan Shift, yeah. Okay, because you just green packed for Carnage Tyrant, and you're just like, oh, Jesus, this is horrible. Yeah.
All right, on to Brad's list. He's got 6. He's got Dredge, and that's another repeat.
Yep.
We haven't had many repeats so far. Interesting. No. All right, let's go on to number 5.
I think a lot of our repeats, I have them ranked higher than you do or vice versa.
Okay.
Number 5, I have Storm.
Okay, Storm.
Gift Storm.
Yeah.
The deck is just generically very powerful, and it's super redundant. So this is that combo deck that has a fail rate that you would expect to be pretty high, but with Opt, Remand, Serum Visions, Sleight of Hand, Metamorphose, Gifts Ungiven, you have so much filtering and tutoring and cantripping that, like, your fail rate's ridiculously low.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, the fail rate is, like, you do all the stuff, and then you don't have a Remand at the end, and they counter your thing. You're just like, well, got me. the printing of Baral made this deck so consistent and made Gifts Ungiven a playable magic card.
Yeah.
Like, because giving you 8 mana reducing creatures that allowed you to play Gifts Ungiven on turn 3 right after you casted Baral, and making it relevant and possible to, like, consistently do that made this deck super good. And, like, get the standard Giftstone Given Pile of Mana Morphos, Ritual, Passing Flames, Grave Shot just kills your opponent. Because, like, you're probably going to untap and just, like, Ritual, you know, Passing Flames, Grave Shot, like, go off. Or, like, if you just get Ritual, Passing Flames, Mana Morphos, and you have a Brawl in play, you just make a bunch of mana, Passing Flames, make a bunch of mana, Giftstone Given, end up with a Grave Shot somehow. And
yeah.
Just blow your opponent off the ball.
It's difficult to pinpoint. Consistent. It's difficult to pinpoint where in that process you want to be like casting a counterspell. Like you know, you typically hold back one counterspell at a time in the early turns. And this deck happens to be able to go off on turn three, and it's like, where's the pressure point here? It's probably, you know, like when Metamorphos is cast, but depending on when that occurs and how much mana he's got left or she's got left. Yeah.
So the problem with this deck is that. Because you have all the creatures that are basically soul rings or more, it's weak to creature removal. So like you can pick it apart and make them just triangle off the natural way if you can remove the dudes that make things cost less. And it makes it like it's funnily very challenging for Storm to go off when you take the creatures off the table. Which, you know, Lightning Bolt, Fatal Push, Path to Exile, very good at. And so backing that up with cheap counterspells like Spell Snare, Negate, Logic Knot, Mana Leak, puts you in a pretty good spot to interact with them. But you're noticing that the trend here is if you're not blue and black or blue and X, you're going to struggle a little bit with Storm unless you're racing them and you're able to beat them off to the finish.
Right. All right, going on, number five. My number five is Affinity.
Yeah.
We already talked about why it's good. Same reasons apply. Brad has got at number five Grixis Death Shadow, and that was another deck that he played quite a bit of. So to see it ranked this low must mean something. He didn't mention he hadn't even been testing it for the recent events. He hadn't even considered it.
I don't even have it on my list.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's not even there.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So, let's continue on. Number four, Daryl.
Collecting Company.
Okay.
Whatever version you like to play, whether it's let me be specific: Court of Calling plus Collected Company combo decks, whether it be Devoted Druid or Kitchen Finks or whatever Collected Company combo you're playing of choice. That's a generic toolbox deck, Eldritch Evolution style as well as an available way to do it with Kiki Jiki and Angel.
Another deck that consistently win on turn three.
Yeah, can consistently win on turn three. Has a bunch of variations in how it does it. Weak to creature removal, but a lot of your creatures are 2-for-1s or better. And you're playing 4 Eternal Witness with Court and Company, and you've got some decks like Kiki Jiki and Resto, and Pia and Kieran, and Voice of Resurgence, and there's the Naya Company, or there's the Obzon Company that's the Kitchen Finks combo, and there's just straight up green white Devoted Druid, and then there's Bant that has the Nightfall.
Yeah.
There's just a bunch of different combos that you can play in these decks, but it's kind of the same show, which is Mana Creatures, Collected Company, Eternal Witness, generic powerful green creatures with value plays like Voice of Resurgence, Kitchen Finks, Scavengers, and then toolbox creatures like Quasali Pride Mage, Burlington Forgefender, the one-offs that you go fetch in a certain instance, a Fulminator Mage, some in the main board, or an Avalanche Riders, to be able to usually topped off by a Revelark or a Kiki-Jiki.
You're almost talking about three different decks at this point, but I think specifically the company that is most played is the Abzan Company and
or the just straight green white the Devoted Druid Company is
right.
The one that's most often played.
There's a black splash typically in those just in the Viscera Seer for the Kitchen Finks version of that.
The Kitchen Finks combo too for the double combo. Yeah.
Now all of these versions have some kind of combo or some kind of some kind of lock. Because there's the green-white version that is just the land destruction one, too.
Yeah.
But the backup plan in all those is just so strong. It's like, if you want to go mid-range, you can, and you can do it really well, because you've got access to the best mid-range creatures.
Yeah, you can grind people out of the game with just Collected Company into Eternal Witness, into Collected Company into Eternal Witness,
Insert Tireless Tracker here.
Yeah, Tireless Tracker. Well, Eternal Witness and X, you get two. And you can just cord into Restoration Angel and play Eternal Witness, depending on what version you're playing. You just have the ability to just put Eternal Witness into play so many times that you're just like, I'm going to put two creatures into play now, and you have to Wrath.
Yeah.
Oh, you did? I'm going to put two more creatures into play. Oh, one of them's Eternal Witness. I'll do that later. And
yeah,
you can just keep generically like running your opponent over with all this value.
Yep. For my number four, transitioning here, I took a little bit of a gamble with this one because it's only been rising in popularity recently, and it's been placing a lot recently, but that is Tron, and I just mean good old-fashioned Tron, not Eldrazi Tron.
Green X Tron?
Mono Green Tron specifically has been good in the last few weeks. We've seen a lot of top eight finishes with that one. In fact, some first-place finishes with it, but Green Black is, you know, pretty similar in almost... Yeah.
Green X Tron. They all kind of function the same way. Try to go 1-2-7.
Daryl, what'd you do? The cops are there?
No, it was the ambulance.
Okay.
Just outside my apartment. But yeah, just trying to go 1-2-7. You know, trying to hit that card and liberate it on turn 3 and blowing your opponent out of the water. So this is another one of those decks where we talked about fail rate earlier. Like, you would think this deck has a very high fail rate because you have to get three specific four ofs in play to do the thing.
Yeah.
But you would be wrong. Because in a format where we ban Ponder and Preordain, we have look at the top five, pick one.
Yeah.
That seems kind of suspicious. That seems like out of place for one green, not like for two green or two and a green, for one green, for G. That seems a little out of place. Plus you have Expedition Map and Sylvan Scrying to suitor up the right lands. And you have, you know, Chromatic Star, Chromatic Sphere to draw cards and filter your mana to be able to cast your green spells. Like, you have all of this redundancy in avoiding the fail rate.
Right. Yeah, I think any deck that's playing, like, Worldbreaker main deck as one of its win conditions also has just ways of dealing with the biggest problems that the deck could face. Be it like Blood Moons and things like that. Like it's a real deal to just like manage to get seven lands and then Worldbreaker your greatest
the Blood Moon and go off. Yeah.
Yeah.
Also worth noting, you brought up Worldbreaker. It's actually a really important piece to the deck. Is that like this deck got much better after Worldbreaker's printing, and I don't see enough people do this. You can just pick it up out of the graveyard.
Yeah.
Like, the problem with Tron is that, like, you could play, like, a blue deck against Tron, and if they didn't, like, 1-2-7 you, you could just grind them out. Because, like, after they banned Iowagon, there was no Emrakul, people didn't play it. So, like, if you could, like, get lands back into play after you get Ulamogged, like, you could just counter all of their relevant things, and then they just have, like, Oblivion Stones and lands. And you're just like, I don't care. You have nothing.
Yep.
Whereas, like, Worldbreaker gave them this thing where if you're not playing a Crypt or you don't path it, like, they can just throw away a generic Forest or a Ghost Quarter or some crappy leftover land and have a 5-7 attacker that exiles your lands every turn of the game until you're dead. Which is really important. Like, it's a very important thing. Plus, you know, the new innovations of you can have Walking Ballista, you can have Thought Knotseer, you have Thragtusk. Like, this diverse and large quantity of threats that are available to you for this deck that people start really finally putting all the pieces together with makes the deck really good. And then just like you have the generic, extremely powerful 1-2-7 car and kill your land, which just ends games. Like people that just put Tron and play on turn 3 and kill land, that's one of the biggest concessions I've ever seen on Moto streams. Oh, he played a card, I'm dead. Game 2, you know, go to my sideboard, see what I got. Know that I'm bad at this and have, like, seven cards in this matchup, you know?
Yeah.
And then, like, you have very real side, like, main boardable cards like Ugin that just blow Dredge and permanent-based decks out of the water. And you have Ulamog, it's just, like, this unkillable threat when you get to the top end that just exiles your opponent's lands and leave them for broke, you know? So the problem is you do have to beat the aggressive decks. That's why you have Direct Dust on your sideboard. That's why you have Fatal Push if you're playing green-black or Pyroclasm if you're playing green-red. Or Lightning Bolt, whatever your, you know, soup du jour.
Yeah, you've got Oblivion Stone, always.
And you have four Oblivion Stones. Yeah, you have four straight-up Wrath of Gods for the whole board. Like, your Planeswalkers all get it out.
Yeah.
So, like, just a very consistent, you know, the Mulligan to five, you could still just put Tron together and play card on turn three. And it's not unreasonable to see that happen. And I think that's what's so frustrating that people hate about the deck, that they want it banned. But I think it's also just a good, a big reason why I would want to pick it up.
Yeah, yeah, I think it's a really good choice right now. In fact, GP Oklahoma City, which just happened last weekend, we have 3 Tron decks in the top 8 and 1 Tron deck in 9th. And as far as modern results go lately, that is the biggest representation of
what
we've
huge.
Seen in the top 8.
That's a huge amount of people doing that, like top 8.
Yeah. And I mean, look at who's playing these decks, too. We've got Seth Manfield playing one of them. The other guys I don't know, but you look around and you look beyond that. 12th place, Steve Rubin is playing Tron. These are players that know what the heck they're doing. They're making informed decisions.
Yeah.
All right, let's go on.
Number four
is somewhere on this list. Let me find it. Number four is Lantern Control.
All right.
So we'll
talk about that later.
What Lantern Control's deal is.
We'll talk about that later.
All right. Going on.
Number three. I got Titan Shift.
Okay.
Specifically, Titan Shift playing Hour of Promise, giving you like 6 to 8 Titan effects to put Battle Cuts into play. But we talked about it. It's a good deck.
Okay. Cool. My number three is Storm. We already talked about Storm, but I will maintain that it is one of the most difficult combo strategies to beat. A lot of the other combo decks in the format have, like one card that can totally hose them, but also does things in other matchups. Whereas, like, Eidolon of Rhetoric is very good in other matchups. Like, I like it in Burn. I like it in, like, decks that have Snapcaster Mage. It's, like, the only type of strategy that works in this particular matchup. And now these Storm decks are running, like, Dismember and stuff so they can deal with Eidolon of Rhetoric. So that's not even good enough, you know?
Yeah, so, you really need
Rule of Law.
Yeah, and they play Echoing Truth or whatever. And the thing about Storm is it's really good in this list we talked about at the very beginning. It's really good for a beginning pilot to pick up and play because there's just always a path, like always the gifts line. It just is like ritual, metamorphose gifts or a path to flames. That's just a no-brainer slam dunk that like you can just learn that. It's like learn it like a goldfish as a new player, and then intricate, very good Storm players. The possibilities are endless.
Yeah, Brad's number three is Jeskai Control, which was your number 10. Right?
Okay,
yeah. So yeah, he's got pretty.
Was his like Geist of Saint Draft, or was his like actual control?
I assume so. That's kind of what the Jeskai deck is right now. Is the Geist and Spellcaller? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Numero Dos. I have green black Tron, green X Tron.
Oh, you do. And black, we just talked about that one.
Yeah, black's the flavor of the day, but I have green X Tron for as much as I hate to play the deck. To play against the deck, and I don't want to admit it. It's really, really good.
Yeah, I can't believe we're talking about Tron in this conversation. Three weeks ago, I wouldn't have never even thought about putting my list.
So here's the thing: when Tron gets bad, Tron gets good.
That's right.
Because Tron gets bad, and people are like, "I don't need 3 Blood Moons. I'll play 1 or 2. I don't need 4 Fulminator Mages. I can go down to 2." You know, I don't need to play a deck that can play four Ghost Quarters. I can play 1 Ghost Quarters out to man lands. And then I'm just like, yeah, Tron land. There's you're just like, damn it, I left all that at home today. And that's what happens.
Yeah, but when it gets good, it gets bad too. Because
when it gets good, it gets horrible. Because then people are like, 4 Crumble to Dust, 3 Blood Moon, let's go.
Yeah, Ceremonious Rejection is still hanging around. All right, my number two is Grixis Death Shadow. And I'm surprised it's not even on your list at all, but I think it's still really good. There's a lot of creature strategies going around, and I don't mean in our lists, but I mean like in the meta right now, like particularly on Modo, like that's all I'm seeing is like humans decks and the new Merfolk decks and like Collected Company decks and things like that. And this deck just plays a lot of like pinpoint removal and like Terminates and Dismembers and Kolgan's Command and things like that. Fatal Push. And so I think it's really good as like a deck to control those strategies, but also is like just a really damn aggressive deck that can just like make the combo decks just pay.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know why I didn't have it in the list. I just wasn't really. It doesn't excite me to play it, and I think it's the learning curve is so high that it's really hard for a person. Because I took it as like if I'm picking up and playing a deck. I don't want to pick up Grixis Death Shadow and just walk into a GP with it. Yeah. Like, the learning curve of maintaining your life total with that deck has got to be so high that you're just going to lose so many games in a GP because of it.
Yeah.
And so, like, I think that's why I just put it, lower on the list. Because, like,
Tron, learning how to 127, not particularly hard. Learning how to put enough mountains into play to scape shift, not particularly hard. Collect the company lines, not tough when you hit the Eternal Witnesses. Yeah. Stuff like that.
Yeah.
Storm has a straightforward line of, like, gift for these four cards, and most of the time you're just going to kill your opponent. Like, there is some fail rate, but you have to get unlucky. Like, that deck is extremely powerful, but I can't condone, like, first-time players to pick it up and go to GP mode.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, Brad's number two,
yeah,
is Tron, green black Tron.
Yeah, we agreed. I agreed with Brad.
Yeah, basically he's saying that this is the deck he should be playing right now. So there you go.
Obviously not, because he has a number one.
So. He does have a number one, but I don't think he is as fond of it personally. So let's go on to your number one,
Lantern.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say that.
Oh, yeah. So, like, really? we established at the bottom of the list, when we talked about John, that Thoughtseize is a hell of a magic card.
Yeah, it is. It's good.
So, the problem that, you know, with 8-Rack and Abzan is that you Thoughtseize your opponent, and then they have nothing. And then you lose to the top of their deck.
Yeah.
So, what if we played a deck that couldn't lose to the top of their deck? I feel like that's a genius idea. So, all the sarcasm aside, like, it's not unrealistic to lock up an opponent by turn two or three. Like, you Inquisition or Thoughtseize them. You take the, like, super aggressive card that's going to beat you down and cause you to lose, or you take, like, the card that's pivotal to their strategy. Like, that might pick your strategy apart or something like that. Take it away from them. And then turn two, you can establish a soft lock. Lantern, thingamajig, mill artifact, go. So now you know what your opponent's drawing, you know what their hand is, you have perfect information, and all you have to do is make sure you play yourself into a position where you don't lose. And are there times where you can get unlucky and you mill your opponent's Stony Silence and they have a second one, or a Disenchant, or some nonsensical card like that? Absolutely. Those are things that can happen. But you are in control of making the decision of, can you beat the card that's on top of their deck? And with perfect information, can you beat that card? And so that's a big deal, and it provides you, I think, the most flexibility. Now, the problem is, there are games you will certainly lose to creature strategies when you don't draw in Snaring Bridge and they attack you for 10.
Yep.
Like, that is Lantern's fail rate, is you didn't draw in Snaring Bridge. Which is kind of awkward, but you can also play with a heavy discard and fatal push strategy so that they just don't have creatures to attack you regardless of if there's an Ensnaring Bridge.
Uh-huh.
And you also get to play Engineer Explosives because you're a Rainbow Land 5-color deck. So you can blow it up for 2 or 3 or whatever and kill whatever non-land permanents or problem. Academy Ruins is a 2 of in your mana base, or at least it should be. You can play Crucible Worlds, like, you can create all these inevitabilities with this deck. You just have to get through the first, like, 3 turns. Which is a tall order in Modern. It's not easy. But it's very doable.
And in 5 colors, you've got access to the most efficient removal spells to deal with those first 3 turns.
Yeah.
Perfect Nodes is particularly good in that case.
Yeah, plus you can play Aether Grid if you are afraid of Stony Silence.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
As a backup one, Kish. So, cool.
Well, I can see that. I think Lantern, like, is the deck that many of the pros agree is the best.
Like, the reason why it's so good right now is because of War of Invention.
Yeah.
Because the fail rate came from not ever drawing Snaring Bridge, and now you have 8 Snaring Bridges.
Yeah.
So.
All right. Let's go on to... Well, that was your number one, right?
Yeah, your number one.
All right, my number one. I have Company as my number one, and I
color me surprised. Corey is a sucker for a good old green white creature strategy.
But let me just tell you this: I know it's maybe not the popular opinion that it's the strongest deck, but it's certainly in a lot of people's top fives. And so I'd say, absolutely, in the hands of the right player, I think Company has the most versatility in game one, as far as being able to deal with the most strategies just in the main deck. But then also, there's just so much potential for, you know, like, some decks have an optional like five like flex spots in their sideboard at you know, like that would be a high number of cards that you can just kind of like swap in and out of your sideboard. This one's just got like just this huge lots and lots of choices. Yeah, basically is what I'm saying. And being a toolbox deck running a one of, you effectively have like nine copies of the card because it could be a creature that you can get off of Coco or Court of Calling.
Sure.
I think that just the explosive potential of this deck paired with the ability to just beat down so fast and so hard and so efficiently with the mid-range strategy is just, it's really, really good. But you've got to know your deck and you've got to know the meta well.
So I'm going to jump in here.
Yeah, go for it.
With the caveat of, you know, if we're going to say, you know, being a master with your deck matters, Lantern would not be my number one deck. So you brought that up at the very beginning that in the right hands, sure, in the right hands, Affinity is an unbeatable deck.
Yeah, that's true. I did say that.
So that's the problem is that, like, to pick up and play, like, Collect Company has the generic, like, I Eternal Witness you and just Collect Company you into the ground until you're dead.
Yeah.
Like, but, like, for just people that are just going to go to the GP, I would much rather be playing Lantern. Like, you've picked, you know, three very skill-intensive decks for the three things that you would advise people who are just going to a modern GP to pick up.
Yeah, that's fair. I suppose it is hypocritical to bring that up. But however, Lantern Control has a huge learning curve. I think many people players would agree with that. Many people avoid the deck because of the learning curve. They don't want to learn the deck and lose the matches. And so
here's the deal. I don't feel like Lantern has as steep a learning curve as you guys, that as people say it does. Because in my brain, it seems pretty straightforward. You're playing a perfect information deck. Figure out what you can't beat and don't let it happen.
Yeah, that makes sense. But being able to assemble your lock is not an easy task.
Well, I mean, and that is part of the fail rate. That's, you know, but you are playing, you know, Green Ponder and Ancient Stirrings, which I still don't know how this card is legal. I'm going to be confused the whole time. You have the most one of the most powerful cards in Modern in Mox Opal.
Mm-hmm.
And you have the other most powerful card in Modern in Thoughtseize. Like, you get to play a perfect information game, you get to accelerate yourself past your opponent, and then you get to put Lantern into play, and, like, you are literally going to play a perfect information game. And at that point, it's on your ability to interpret what can you and can't you afford to like, let happen.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is a very real skill that people have to have. But even as a beginning Lantern pilot, you can look at the top card of your opponent's deck and look at the board and go, oh, you have lands. You can have a land. Oh, that's a Tarmogoyf. I'm at 7. I can't beat that card. Put it in your graveyard. Like as a beginning player, you can put the pieces together pretty quick and be like, yeah, I should not let you have that. So, like,
yes, I
think
I
it's
agree.
The most powerful deck. I seriously do think that Lantern is the most powerful deck.
Totally. Like, yeah, that's fair. That's fair. It probably is the most powerful deck. I probably should have included it in my list somewhere.
Yeah, but, I did that with Death Shadow, so I'll
but the ability to pilot your own deck is not merely like informed by your understanding of what your opponent currently has. I think you have to really know your deck and know what strategies work and what sequencing work. With Collected Company, yes, you need to be aware of the meta. You need to know like what sorts of sideboarding pieces are effective and what your opponent's going to do to sideboard against you. That's true of anything. Collected Company has a pretty solid and pretty linear game plan of, I need to find Devoted Druid. I need to get that into play first, and I play Vizier next, and I need to find a way to draw my deck and get you know, my win condition.
Sure. I mean, we can argue minutiae, but
we can't argue
you know, the whole all day. But there is something to be said, like, some of these decks are obviously like Grixis the Shadow and Company and Storm are gonna be harder to pick up and play. Some of these are gonna be easier.
Well, either way, it's interesting to see the differences in our lists. Particularly even in our top three. I think we have three totally different decks in our top three. Leaves us just one left. That's Brad's number one. Can you guess what it is?
No.
It's hard to keep track of what we've said and what we haven't yet. You want me to review the list?
Ten
is Eldrazi Tron, 9 is Titan Shift, 8 is Connor's Company, 7 Humans, 6 Dredge, 5 GDS, Grixis Death Shadow, 4 Lantern Control, 3 Jeskai Control, 2 Tron, and number 1 is...
I don't know.
Storm. It's Storm.
Oh, okay, yeah.
That's fair.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. That's fair. I was just like, which one didn't he say that would have made sense? Storm. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's fair. That's fair. Yeah, I mean.
All right.
Storm. Powerful deck, like.
So anything on my list or anything on Brad's list that you're just like, well, I'm surprised about that one.
Maybe I should. No. Eight rack was the 8 rack at Eldrazi in Texas, the bottom.
Yeah, the last two.
The last two. Everything else, I'm just like, yep, that plays. That totally plays. All that is fine. Like, yeah. And I have a feeling that Abzan might be the only questionable one on my list because Grixis Death Shadow is actually just a better version of Abzan.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, just totally forgot Grixis Death Shadow was a deck.
Yeah, I think it is a better version of Abzan. That's a good way to put it.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, cool. Well, I think we better wrap it up at that. We're going long today, but definitely a useful conversation to have. The takeaway here is that Modern is vast and diverse, and there's no clear best deck, despite us all being able to, you know, to find one that we think is the best. I certainly am not convinced that I've made the right choices in any of my top 10. But I think that there's a lot out there that is really pretty powerful in this format. And Wall Lantern is kind of a understood to be the best deck. We've had many moments in the last, you know, 6 months or so that people have said, you know, Death Shadow is the best deck in Modern. And then the next weekend, that's just like totally turned on its head.
I feel comfortable saying that I'm confident that Lantern is El Numero Uno.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for listening. We will see you next time. On Card Knock Life.
Later.
Card Knock Life is proud to be a part of mtgcast.com. We can be reached at cardknocklifepodcast.com or on Twitter at card_knock_life. We're always looking for more help in generating content for the website. And if you'd be interested in doing so, please email at cardknocklifepodcast@gmail.com.